Yeah, thanks. So I will say a couple of words about how we connect the scattering amplitudes that we all love so much and work on to some experimental reality that people might finally observe in the detector. And that is done, or that can be done, using Monte Carlo event generators. Okay. So, what is it that we calculate? We at the LHC we have two incoming protons, and then we have a scattering amplitude for say two gluons producing a TT bar pair and maybe in association with a Higgs, and then the Higgs can decay, for example in TT in dB bar, and the tops will decay. Produce W's, the W's in turn decay, maybe one produces a lepton, maybe one produces quarks in the final state. Sorry. Okay. So what is experimental reality? Well, at some point out here, somewhere, there is an electromagnetic calorimeter, and there is some photon going and depositing some energy in this calorimeter. And we want to know how we relate the final state that we have computed here to this reality, quote unquote. Okay, so this photon can either come from a QED emission of this lepton, for example, but it can also be produced by decaying pi zero, for example. And this pion comes in some way from a colored QCD pattern that is in the final state of our amplitude, and we have to describe the transition from this, from these colored QCD patterns to the color neutral hadrons that are observed in the experiment. Okay, so this is done usually doing by heavy modeling, essentially. Well, it's not only heavy modeling; there are also some ideas about local pattern hadron duality and so on, which are encoded in a fragmentation model. Or hadronization model. That is essentially the end of the event simulation in the Monte Carlo, which turns some QCD patterns into hadrons, and then these hadrons can also decay. They can radiate photons in their decay and so on. But that's not so interesting for me here. So this hadronization happens at a rather low scale. Of the order of lambda QCD, say 1 GeV. Okay? So this is sort of the order of the invariant mass of the bound states or so. On the other hand, our amplitude here lives, quote unquote, at a very high scale because it involves a large invariant momentum transfer. Okay? Amplitudes, let's see, scale is lambda QCD here, and the scale, say, of the order of a TeV, maybe at the LHC, right? So for example, the top quarks are very heavy, so the scale is at least the mass of the top quarks here, 175 GeV, or maybe even higher if we also produce two and a Higgs. And we have to somehow bridge the gap between this very high scale and this very low scale here. And you all know that accelerated charges radiate, and that's not only true in QED but also in QCD. So the accelerated QCD charges here will radiate something before they finally get gobbled up into the color neutral hadrons. And this is finally what I will speak about. This is, that's all gluons. This is the concept of a parton shower. Implementing this QCD radiation in a Markovian Monte Carlo, essentially. Okay? Essentially describing the emissions of multiple gluons or other patterns independently in a very efficient way, such that we can quickly produce, starting from a hard process, a final state, or simulate a final state as it is observed by the experiment. And then, of course, the radiation can not only happen in the final state, but it can also happen in the initial state. okay? And in the end, all of that has to be connected somehow to the proton remnants as well. Okay, so we had hadrons here, we had another fragmentation here, more hadrons coming out, and of course everything is correlated in the end, so I'm just drawing a simplified picture. Then at the LHC, it's not any plus and minus collision, we have two incoming hadrons, and in principle we have the possibility that we observe or we resolve another parton in the proton which can undergo a separate collision. And again, the initial and final state particles can radiate a lot. Okay. So this produces a whole mess of QCD particles in the end, turned into hadrons by our fragmentation model. And then these guys finally go in the detector. Okay. So this is the context, and what I speak about is essentially these branchings here, which are modeled by the parton Schauer. And then, yeah, there. Right. The parton Schauer is useful because the experimentalist, in a sense, can use it to correct his observed signal back to the particle level. This is what we don't like so much. The theorist, on the other hand, can use it to turn, as I said before, his parton level prediction into a hadron level prediction, and the experimentalist then compares it to his signal. That's what we like better. And it's important every time when you don't only want to connect one of these final state partons to some jet that you observed. So jet is a spray of particles, as Jeppe Andersen explained previously, somewhere in the region of the calorimeter. But when you also want to resolve the internal structure of such a jet. So if for example, if you want to do a subjet analysis, this is very popular, or another example would be where you definitely see the effect of the parton Schauer. If you compute Drellian lepton pair production at leading order, you look at the PT spectrum. This is just a delta function, right? Because the Drellian lepton pair has no PT. The experimental reality is somewhat like this. More or less exponentially falling distribution, and your parton Schauer can convert this leading order prediction into something that is experimentally relevant, except for the normalization, but I will come to that later. So it's really important. If you look a bit closer into the detailed structure of the final states. Okay, so how does it work? Well, we all know that our QCD amplitudes, real emission corrections, exhibit soft and collinear divergences. So our simplest case for explaining how this works is always E plus E minus going to hadrons, and the real emission correction looks like this, where this is a intermediate gamma star or Z. And in the limit, this guy factorizes into the Born level and some universal piece here, which encodes essentially the spin structure of the interaction, which is just, in the simplest case, the Dirac splitting function. And then we have the integral here over the intermediate propagator, which gives you the leading logarithm together with the soft gluon divergence there. Okay. So this guy is divergent. It will give us an epsilon pole, but at finite resolution, which is always the case here in the detector because our calorimeter cells have a finite width, we don't see a pole, we see a large logarithm. So finite resolution turns poles into large logarithms. And, okay, these guys must be resummed to all orders. Because if the logarithm is large, and you can imagine this can be iterated,
then your your perturbation series will not converge because you have the same correction at every order again. Okay. Okay. And then in the leading logarithmic picture, we can associate the logs with these 1-to-2 parton splittings that I have sketched here, in a sense. So we always like to draw these little charts, where here we have the order of the calculation, an alpha s, and here we have the number of logs. And then at this order, essentially, so order alpha s, you have two logs. That's the leading one, subleading one. Next order, you have a couple more, and so on. And what the parton shower does is it sums up all these guys here. And if you do it in a smart way, then it can also sum up these. Okay. So these are resummed in the parton shower. And then there are other methods. So these are, so to say, subleading logarithms, which are encoded in the hard, in the full hard matrix element that you can compute for this process. They are not encoded in the parton shower, but you can add them to the parton shower in a suitable scheme. Okay, I will probably come to that later if I have enough time. Okay, so that is the first approximation of the parton shower, right? We don't take all the logarithms into account, but only the leading two. Sometimes only the leading one. Another important approximation is that we work in the large NC limit. Okay. Okay. And that is nice because we only have planar amplitudes or planar diagrams in our amplitude. That means we can unambiguously identify for every fundamental color or anti-color index a color partner, so to say, as we say in the parton shower language. Okay.
Isn't it equivalent to you said that you're assigning leading logs? I believe the level leading logs you have only planar contribution. There is no planar contribution to the level leading logs.
Yes, that's what?
As soon as you're talking about leading logs, it may be a non-leading one, but for me, it does not. But for leading logs only come from the planar diagrams.
Yes, yes.
Therefore, it's equivalent to saying leading logs and planars are equivalent.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Yeah, it's just another way of saying it, that's true. Okay. So now I want to connect this to a bit more of a formal way of writing these things, which are
the leading logs also effectively planar because of the structure of the silk over two loops now.
Depends whether you count number of quark flavors. It's the level next to leading logs you will count the ratio of quark flavors or number of colors. So depending on how you treat this parameter.
If you treat this parameter small, then they're effectively planar also.
Okay, so I've already written down here a bit of notation that I would like to use. I hope it's visible from the other side. I will write the Born level cross section, which depends on a certain set of momenta as the sum over flavor contributions. That's denoted by this F here. And then the single pieces in this sum depend on the full information on the parton, which I denote by A, that has flavor information and the momentum information. And then I can again split up this piece into a phase-based integral and into a Born-level matrix element, and that consists of a parton luminosity factor that includes the PDFs. And some reduced matrix element, which is just the amplitude squared divided by a flux factor and the symmetry factor. And this phase space integral also includes the phase space integral, or the integral over the momentum fractions of the initial state partons with respect to the incoming proton. And then there's the final state phase space. Okay, so that's sort of the notation. And then what we can do is we do the same thing for the real emission piece. We write a real emission differential cross section as a phase space integral that only depends on the parton momenta. And then here we have the matrix element that depends on the full parton information. Okay, and we rewrite this in a very convenient way. We say, okay, we do a trivial factorization. So we write this as a Born phase space integral, where we have some mapping of the real emission configuration onto a Born configuration, which I denote by this B here. Then the Born matrix element with the same mapping that acts also on the flavors. And then we have here some integral over the phase space of the one additional parton, in the sense that, okay, that's the phase space of this emission here, essentially. And then here just the ratio of the full real emission matrix element over the Born. Okay. So that is the structure, essentially. Then you can write this as the Born differential cross-section times a radiation probability that only depends, in the ideal case, on the extra emission. So this guy here is the radiation probability, the differential radiation probability. And then, that one depends on B of A. And then the tricky point in the parton shower is to find a suitable mapping here of the real emission configuration onto the Born configuration, or vice versa. Because the parton shower works essentially the opposite way. We don't start from real emission configuration, we start from Born configuration, and then something is emitted. Okay. So this, this mapping here, B is actually connected to an inverse mapping, which I will call R, which maps a Born configuration onto a real emission configuration using this extra phase space here and some flavor configuration. There's some extra flavor that has been generated. Okay. And the problem is that the factorization of the amplitudes is only derived usually in the strict limits, soft or collinear limits. And in that case, we don't have an ambiguity here in this mapping B, because in the strict collinear limit, I can just sum up the momenta of two partons and I get an on-shell momentum back. Or in the soft limit, I can just remove the gluon and I will get an on-shell configuration back. However, in reality, we never have that situation. Because we have a finite detector resolution, so we always have a small transverse momentum between two partons. So we have to define an unambiguous procedure to, as we say, reshuffle the momenta of a Born configuration into a real emission configuration and have both of them on shell. So we can compute something meaningful here and there. Okay. So that is now parton shower construction. How to define that? Well, essentially, we assume that our real emission matrix element can be written as a sum of terms, and I just make it sufficiently general and introduce a dipole-like notation where we have a spectator parton. So we have here a sum over, so to say, daughter partons that are these two guys here, and the spectator parton, which is different from both. And then we define dipole contributions, dijk of A, and in a pictorial way, this looks like this. We have here our
n plus 1 parton real emission amplitude. And in the limit, we can write this as this sum essentially over a Born level contribution times the universal splitting function. And you will know this picture from Catani-Simo dipole factorization. Okay, and this is one of these Dij case. So this is essentially one of these contributions encodes the limit when these two partons I and j become collinear, essentially. So that's the whole trick. Okay, more formally, this Dijk is given by Born configuration times a symmetry factor times a propagator factor. That's really very easy. Times 8 pi alpha s times the splitting kernel. Okay, and that guy only depends on the momenta of the three particles which are involved in the splitting. And now the trick is that since we have identified the particles which participate in the splitting, we now have a unique mapping of the Born level configurations onto the real emission, or the other way around. Okay, same way Catani-Simo works. Catani-Simo dipole factorization works. Okay. Now we combine this guy with the phase space factor, and we write down our Parton-Chow approximation of the differential radiation probability for one of these contributions, and that is just an integral, and you can see here how the logarithmic structure of the Parton-Chow emerges. 2 pi alpha s over 2 pi 1 psi j, okay, that's our new symmetry factor here, times some Jacobian, which only depends on t and z, some splitting kernel, and some luminosity ratio. Okay, sorry. This way. Okay, so two things. First of all, you can...
Definition of the luminosity ratio that you actually multiply the parton distributions by x. This is what in this formula then ensures you that you get the right momentum for action factors.
Yes, that's what I just wanted to say actually.
Okay, sorry.
So
because there's two definitions of luminosity and you sort of use the more uncommon one. And,
yes.
Okay.
In order to have a simpler task here. So what happens if we have only final state partons involved in the splitting, then this is 1, of course. And if we have initial state partons involved, then we get here an x over z times f of x over z with a new flavor here divided by x f I j, the combined flavor, x and t, like this. And that gives an extra factor of 1 over z, which combines with this one into the right factors, into the right momentum fractions, essentially. Okay, yes, so you can see essentially this one. So this in this picture, you get very nicely the backward evolution equation as introduced by Torbjörn Sostrand. It's done there in the references. Without having to do additional work, so you automatically get this ratio of PDFs here in a way which is also consistent with the picture of the final state shower, and you see essentially already the logarithmic structure emerging if you integrate this guy here over z, and you have a gluon splitting involved, you get 1 log, and if you integrate again, you get a double log, okay, because you have 1 log here already.
and then you get power corrections from running of alpha s and so on. Okay. What did I want to say next? Right. So the full differential radiation probability, of course, is then just the sum over all these dipole contributions. So that is very nice, but so far we have treated only real emissions with some resolution criterion, but as we take the resolution to zero, we will still get a divergence, which cannot be true. We know, however, that the divergence is removed by the virtual correction, so in the end we have a unitarity constraint here, and that will lead to a Poisson statistics for the number of emissions that is implemented in this scheme. So we have to essentially sum up infinitely many of these radiation probabilities, but in the end everything must be unitarized, and that introduces a low emission probability, which we call a Sudakov form factor. It's not exactly the same as Sudakov form factors initially defined, but we nevertheless call it a Sudakov form factor. Which is associated with essentially with the mother parton and its spectator before its splitting, before the splitting, and it describes essentially the probability that there is no parton emission between the two scales T and T prime, between these two evolution scales. But at this point, I have not yet specified what the evolution variable is. Okay, and that because it depends only on I, J, and K. Must be some over flavors here, then we integrate from T to T prime, min to Z max, 0 to pi, and essentially, quote unquote, this differential radiation probability here. Okay, so that's our no emission probability. Okay, and now I come back to this point. If just for the fun of it, we take the logarithmic derivative of this Sudakov form factor with respect to t, and we assume an initial state splitting, and we say, for this argument, we convert this into the usual Altarelli-Parisi splitting function, which depends only on Z. Then, to no surprise, we get exactly the differential form of the Degelab equation back. And we have to sum over parton flavors here, pi, ij, z, fi, x, one z, t, f, ij, t. So that is more or less your question as well. Okay, so that just shows that this is more or less a consistent picture, right? So we haven't messed up anything yet, which is certainly good. Okay, so now how do we turn this into a Monte Carlo algorithm for multiple parton emission here? Well, if this is the no emission probability, in the Parton-Shaw approach, then we have the emission probability, n minus no emission probability. I don't need to write that down. I just say that we can set this 1 minus no emission probability equal to a random number and solve the equation for t. For this guy.
I should probably explain that a bit more in detail. So we have a hard process here with some outgoing partons, and that hard process has a scale T, and now we want to do an additional emission. That has a scale T prime at a scale T. Then we take this probability and we just solve the equation for T. Okay. And then we take the integrand here and generate the parton flavor and the light cone momentum fraction according to that integrand. Okay, so that's the algorithm. That's a basic algorithm. Now I want to go a bit more into the details of what is actually done in the Monte Carlo. Not too much. I just want to mention the problems which are still to be solved. So as I said, we have now a nice way of identifying how the momentum reshuffling works, but we have still not specified how the spectator here is assigned. Right? So this spectator can in principle be many spectators. Why not? Then it just has a virtuality, but that's not a problem. We can still write down some kinematics. And to be a bit more specific, if you consider the case of E plus E minus going to four partons, where you have two splittings subsequently, we call this 1, 2, 3, and 4, and here we have a virtuality T3, 4, and here we have a virtuality T1, 2, and this guy splits after this guy, then the color connection or color correlations are like this. And the spectator of the splitting parton is in principle this parton here. However, I could go back to a situation where I don't know yet that this parton exists, and I say, okay, this is my spectator. Okay. So in the parton shower language, we call this parton the mother, and these are the daughters. And then this guy is the aunt, of course. So the question is whether you want to do your kinematics reshuffling using the aunt or the cousin, essentially, right? And then what Vidya does, uses the aunt on, I say, combination of 1, 2 after the splitting, which is massive. Pelvic. In the old version, it's complicated, and it's not actually possible to identify it in this way, because the reshuffling happens only the full final state is constructed, and that has to do with angular ordered evolution. And Sherpa, just to list the general purpose Monte Carlos, uses the single final state parton, which has to do with the fact that we use essentially the Catani-Simoes subtraction to identify these mappings. However, if you only use Dirac kernels, then your kernel does not depend on the kinematics of the spectator, it only depends on this fraction Z here, so you have the ambiguity which one you want to use for reshuffling. Okay, so this this is really an ambiguity, and you can use it more or less to tune your Monte Carlo better to data. So this is kinematics. Okay. Yeah, just as an example of that this kinematics reshuffling is really important, which you might also, all of you will know from the Catani-Simoes subtraction paper. If your spectator is massless, then the shift when I want to redefine the final state on shell, starting with a real emission configuration, is something like q squared over q squared minus t times the original momentum. And of course, the larger t becomes, the more important this reshuffling becomes, so your final state will look quite different if you go back to this picture here. you will shift the momentum configuration a lot, and this means you predict a totally different signature in the detector if you have large invariant momentum transfers involved in a shower. And as Jeppe Andersen said in his talk, a good approximation doesn't only work in the limit, it is characterized by the fact that it works away from the limit, so if we want to use it away from the limit, that means we really have to work on this point. Okay, so in the parton shower jargon, this is called the recoil strategy. So you know when you talk to people who do parton showers, or also momentum reshuffling. Recoil essentially because the spectator gets rescaled, so it takes some recoil. Okay, and that also introduces then a certain set of next to leading logarithmic corrections which are resummed or not in the algorithm. Great, so the next thing is the evolution variable. So there's an ambiguity there as well. Essentially, right, I should have introduced some kinematics here. I'll do it now. So if you look at such a splitting of a parton ij into parton ij with a spectator k, then you can use a convenient decomposition of the momenta where pi is just c times pij plus k dot squared over c times pk over 2 pij pk plus k prop, and pj is the same just with 1 minus c pk over 2 pij pk minus k prop, and that immediately gives that k prop squared is c times 1 minus c times the virtuality, which is 2 times pi times pj. And I've already written in a more or less intuitive way the virtuality here as the evolution variable. Okay, but in principle, as you see, that the k perp squared is only well, product of the evolution variable and some function that depends on the light cone momentum fractions. We can say that dt over t is the same like dk perp squared over k perp squared, also the same like dq squared over q squared, where q squared is something like t over z times 1 minus z. So essentially the opposite of this guy, right? So this is something like an energy-weighted angle. So you can think of this as d theta squared over theta squared, where theta is more or less half the opening angle between these guys. I've drawn it in a stupid way, essentially. The z-axis is here, so your transverse momentum is here. The angle is more or less here. Okay. And then the difference between the Monte Carlos is how do you do the evolution? So old Pisia and old Chopper, again, to stick with this standard Monte Carlos, use this guy. New Pisia and new Chopper use more or less this guy, where Chopper is defined slightly different from Pisia. And Herwig uses the energy-weighted angle, whereas this is slightly differently defined in the old versus the new versions. Okay, and this has an important important consequence. It's more or less a decision about which logarithmic corrections you really want to resum. And then there are these famous old papers here by Marchesini and Weber, which show that the angular ordering is the correct one,
because it introduces color coherent picture of pattern evolution. So it, if you think of subsequent emissions, you have a proton branching here, quark branches into a quark and a gluon, and then you want to implement emission here, emissions here, from this quark or from this quark or from this gluon. Then the net effect of color coherence is that emissions are only allowed inside the cone, which is spanned by the two proton momenta, whereas they are suppressed outside this cone. That is essentially a statement about a wide-angle gluon not being able to resolve the internal structure of this color dipole. It would only resolve the net color charge, which is carried by its parent proton. So you could emit a wide-angle gluon here, but you couldn't emit it here. Okay. And that that is then, in end effect, encoded in this angular ordered evolution. Okay. So in the end, we have to connect our parton shower to the hard process. And, well, in order to do so, we identify the leading color structure in the hard process. So it's particularly simple to explain it with the case of QQ bar going to QQ bar, where the color flow of the diagram is like that. So your initial dipoles for the parton shower would be once this pair of partons and once this pair of partons, because it's just the color flow of the diagram. And then, of course, you have more complicated structures, or possibly have more complicated processes where you have more color structures. So this guy, for example, has a color flow like that. These are planar amplitudes, but then, of course, there also exists the possibility that the two gluons are crossed, and this is another color flow, which looks like that. And then depending on which is the dominant contribution, you can choose either of these color flows to start your parton shower. Okay. Finally, all of that might not be enough to get a nice description of events in the detector, and you might want to do a matrix element correction on your parton shower, or connect it to higher order, or to the full tree-level matrix element, in that sense that you really want the full result here. Okay. So, matrix element correction, and that is particularly simple to write in this formalism, because we know how we got this, how we got to this formula, essentially by approximating the real radiation matrix element with this guy. So what we can do is we write the real radiation matrix element as a sum over dipole contributions, Rijk, where this Rijk is just, let's say, a projection of the real radiation matrix element. It's not really a projection, but figuratively speaking, it's just the real radiation matrix element multiplied with the relative contribution of this dipole IJK in the full result. Okay. And now we can use these guys instead of our approximations, the IJK, to construct the parton shower algorithm. Now, it's certainly difficult to derive the form of the splitting kernel starting from this form, because it's a process-dependent thing. But what we can do is use a process-dependent correction weight
weight, which is just differential radiation probability in the matrix element approach, like what I sketched here, divided by the Parton-Shaw approximation. Okay, and it turns out that this guy is particularly simple to calculate, because it is actually independent of the assignment of the splitter-spectator pair here. So in principle, the indices occur here, but they don't show up in the full result. Full result is just a sum over, again, a ratio of symmetry factors times Born matrix element divided by real radiation matrix element. Times a pi alpha s over the propagator factor times the splitting kernel. And this is really nice, because this can be automated in the Monte Carlo in a fully automated, it can be automated in the Monte Carlo. Once we have a method to compute tree level cross sections in an automated way, correcting the Parton-Shaw in this manner is easy, because at each and every point where we want to do an emission, we can ask our tree-level matrix element generator for these weights here, and we have the full real radiation pattern as described here, exponentiated. Okay, and this is also the idea, more or less, of the Pauheck method. So we use this ME corrected, matrix element corrected Parton shower plus a local K factor, local in the Born phase space, to bring our whole result to full next to leading order accuracy. We arrive at a full at the full S result too in our event simulation. Where do I have that? So you see here that the seed for generating an event was
previously our Born level cross section.
Now in this method, this Born level cross section is replaced with Born level cross section, as I said, times the K factor, which is local in the Born phase space. And in connection with this re-weighting factor, this gives the order alpha s correct result for the full simulation. Okay. And then in principle, the same technique can be used, or the same formalism can be used, to match also higher order tree level contributions. And that goes under the name Menlops for matrix element at NLO plus Parton-Shaw. That's a phrase which has been coined by Keith Hamilton, and that's quite nice. Okay, how much time do I have left? Okay, in principle, I would also like to show some plots, but I also want to mention that in principle, the same formalism can be used. To treat the possibility of having an additional hard interaction. Okay. Again, our total rate for the production of this hard final state should not change. That means we must have at some point a unitarity constraint. That means we must have some no emission probability or no generation probability for this hard interaction. We only have to find the quote-unquote correct probability or differential probability for generating it.
And that is not possible in, up to now, at least. There's only crude modeling. But what we can do is we assume that the total cross-section dependent on the center of mass energy is some elastic cross-section plus double diffractive cross-section, okay, I skipped the S, plus single diffractive cross-section plus the non-diffractive part, okay? And that the average number of interactions is then given by the hard QCD cross-section, which of course depends on the PT cutoff, because we cannot integrate down to zero, divided by this on the diffractive cross section. Okay, so once we have this, this average number, using Poisson statistics, we can immediately write down the differential radiation probability, and therefore we can write down the no emission probability. So we get something like no emission probability for multiple parton interaction, MPI, between T and T prime, depending on the configuration A, just E to the minus integral of from T T D sigma hard over sigma non-diffractive, well, dT times 1 over sigma non-diffractive. Okay. And now the big trick of Sjostrand and Skans was to realize that this can actually combine with Parton-Shaw Sudakov form factor, and we arrive at a combined model, so to say, for Parton-Shaw plus multiple Parton interaction. It's a model because we will not recover the Dirichlet evolution when we expand this, or, when we take the derivative. So we will mess up the PDFs in this case, but it's a model anyway. Okay, yeah, so the no emission, no radiation probability, it just factorizes into the Parton-Shaw no emission probability and the multiple Parton interaction no generation probability, so to say. Okay, and if we take the derivative with respect to log T, then we get our radiation probability. Okay, so how does that look? We have some evolution variable T here. At some point we have our hard interaction. And now this, the parton which comes from this hard interaction starts evolving down in T, from the hard scale down to the hadronization scale. So somewhere down here is lambda QCD. And on its way, it radiates gluons. But since we have combined our description of Parton-Shaw and multiple interactions, at some point we might have the option to generate a secondary interaction. Secondary hard scattering. And then both of these initial state partons evolve.
So in this model, these are still going with the basic PDF, you're ignoring the essentially the four correlations?
Well, that is a big issue, and there's a separate paper on that, how they treat this. It's essentially, there are two models. The, in the old model, the PDF was just rescaled.
To the lower X or something.
To the lower X, yeah. And then in the newer model, they are trying to extract the fraction of the partons which are taken away here from the PDF somehow. But I don't know the details, actually. I can give you the reference. There's a whole paper on it. Okay, and also we have the option, in principle, if we have more interactions, also with this one, to combine two initial state partons into one, and so on. So there can be more interactions and more emissions. So this is a more sort of inclusive model for QCD, but it's not really as well founded as the Parton-Shaw approximation, of course, because you don't know how to treat the PDFs yet. Okay, and that is more or less it. If the projector works, I can show some of the effects of angular ordered evolution versus virtuality. It's probably just the middle one, probably. Okay, wow, on the spot. Right. Okay, so here we have this famous CDF analysis where they look for color coherence in initial state evolution. The idea is that you take hard jet in a three jet event to be above 110 GeV and request the other jet or require the other jet to be above some threshold anywhere else in the phase space. And then you look at the rapidity of the third jet. And this rapidity distribution shows a bump, a dip. The old Parton-Shower models without coherence effects in initial state evolution, however, showed a bump. That is EtherJet and old Perseus, essentially. And this is Herwig, which implements angular ordered evolution, and that looks fine. It also has the dip. That inspired Torbjörn to look into this into more detail, in more detail, and impose an additional angular veto on top of the virtuality ordered evolution in Pythia also. And then Pythia, you can see, more or less has the dip as well. Okay.
This is Tevatron.
This is Tevatron. Yes, Tevatron 1 here.
From a physics understanding, dip is due to what?
Color coherence effects in the emission, in the combined emission from the first two jets. Because you look at the third jet. That's the idea. And
why does the dip then occur at zero instead of occurring somewhere in between jets one and two?
Well, the whole thing is a bit smeared out because you don't have any. Probably.
Selection on where jets 1 and 2 exactly are in this?
As far as I know, not, but I have to look at it in more detail again. It's in the paper, but the whole thing is smeared out over the phase space because you don't have too many constraints on these two jets.
Okay, so on average, anyhow, the 1-2 system is produced at eta equals 0. Is it that what you're saying? And emission inside the 1-2 system is disfavored over emission outside the 1-2 system?
I would rather think that emission.
It's really the absolute. Could it be that this eta 3 is taken in respect to relative to the eta 1 and eta 2?
I guess.
Well, according to this plot, which I took from the paper, it's not. But I should probably look into it in more detail again. I didn't spend too much time before the talk to look at plot up again. So we can discuss it later, probably, or we should discuss it later again. It has to do with the connection of the Parton shower to the hard interaction, which I explained before, using this color topology. And if you choose the wrong color topology and don't respect the angular ordering constraint which arises from the color topology, then you get it wrong. That's the upshot. And then, okay, just to show that Parton showers are not as crude an approximation as they often seem to be, in principle, there is a statement in the literature that DGLAB and BFKL in the leading log region are essentially equivalent to angular order Parton evolution. And one could therefore maybe assume that angular order Parton showers potentially can also describe some lower X effects, maybe. And there was an analysis also by the CDF collaboration, it's also Tevatron Run 1, where they compared leading log BFKL, that is the open squares here, with the next leading order calculation and with Herwig. And you see that Herwig, with its angular ordering picture, is spot on the data, and the other calculations are completely off. It's not a big surprise because this is leading log BFKL, so it predicts way too much radiation. So you look at an observable which is similar to the ones that Jeppe Andersen showed. It's the azimuthal decorrelation between the forward and the backward hard jet over the rapidity interval between the two.
In that case, jet is leading order.
Yes. Yeah. Well, That's what I was just about to say.
Sorry.
That is definitely missing the higher order effects. So it's obvious that it doesn't describe the data. Okay, but anyway, what I wanted to emphasize is that even for that observable, which was supposed to test for BFKL effects, really, the Parton show is doing a reasonably good job. Okay. And just to mention that there are new developments regarding to dipole showers. So in old dipole showers, people might know Ariadne, the emission of initial state radiation, the emission of initial state gluons was reinterpreted as final state emission of the two remnants, essentially, in this very simple situation of trillion lepton pair production without an additional jet. And now in the new models, that's interpreted in the perturbative picture as emission of the initial state dipole here, rather than the final state dipole here. The net effect of that Ariadne picture was that it predicted too much radiation, and that has to be corrected for by taking into account somehow that the remnant is an extended object, and therefore there should be a phase space suppression of the radiation. But this, again, introduces an additional parameter in the model, which is not nice, whereas in this new description, you don't have a parameter. And then, again, comparing to the same data, you see that despite this Parton show is ordered in transverse momentum, it reproduces this dip because the angular dependence is encoded in the splitting functions, essentially. Okay, and the same is true for this angle alpha, which is this angle here. Okay, this is more or less it. So I hope I convinced you that Parton showers are a nice approximation for multiple Parton emission. They are necessary to model the internal structure of jets, and also, yeah, in general, to get a more inclusive picture of the event. To turn, as I said before, our hard perturbative QCD calculation into something that can be observed in an experiment at the end. And they are not as crude an approximation as they are often considered to be.
Thanks, very nice.